You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at a school district boundary in Wisconsin, which a new report says is among the worst segregating school district borders in the country.
First, ever since the publication of Susan Cain's book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, introversion has been in. People are celebrating the fact that it's okay to stay in, it's okay to need time to recover after lots of social interaction. And yes, it's okay to regulate how much interpersonal stimulation you get.
We talked to some people at WPR about whether they were introverts or extroverts, and here's what they had to say.
Extreme introvert. Any social interaction feels like, you know, those using those hand exercise things where you're like making a muscle, like anytime just making a muscle for an extended period of time, and then you just like, I'm so exhausted by the end of it, just sort of mentally.
When I discovered the term extrovert, I thought that matched with me well. I thought I could very well identify with that term because that explained my personality.
I'm an introvert. I think it's deeply affected my ability to get out there and make my life happen in a really meaningful way.
I am an extrovert, but I oftentimes get mistaken for an introvert because I actually don't like to talk that much. I like to be around people. Even if I'm not speaking to them, just knowing that they are there makes me feel energized.
Because of my job responsibilities and just experience alone, I am still an introvert, but I am not shy anymore. But I do need time to recharge. So I am out talking to people and being seemingly extroverted. It is exhausting for me, and I do need time to go home and just be by myself. It's hugely important for me to do that, recharge my batteries.
Are you an introvert or an extrovert? How important do you think that is to who you are or to the rest of your personality? How do you deal with people who are on a different part of the introvert-extrovert spectrum than you? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Brian Little says people who see themselves as nothing but introverts are limiting themselves, and he's here with us to explain why. He's the author of Me, Myself, and Us, The Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. He's a fellow of the Well-Being Institute and director of the Social Ecology Research Group in the Department of Psychology at Cambridge University. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, why do you think that people who decide that they are introverts are limiting themselves?
Well, it really goes to the whole issue of whether you should label yourself. It's a little bit like putting yourself in a pigeonhole, and I'm not even sure that pigeons belong in pigeonholes. And so I think that the awareness that people began to get in reading Susan Cain's book was really important. They realized that they could be described as introverts, and that didn't mean that they were failures or that they were useless or that they couldn't be expected to rise to occasions. And that was terrific. But now I'm experiencing the phenomenon of introverts perhaps shortchanging themselves and cutting too short the prospects for living well, because they rest in that little rabbit warren that they've created for themselves, and I think that can be constricting.
Are you saying that's in part because of the spotlight that Susan Cain's book Quiet has shined on the value of being an introvert, that people are maybe embracing it too much?
Fewer are perhaps embracing it too much. It's giving them an excuse for not venturing out in their lives. But on whole, the effect of Susan's book has been terrific. It's been emancipatory for a lot of people who thought themselves abnormal or strange because they didn't engage with the social world in a way that their extroverted friends would. And I think that's been wonderful. I do think, however, if you glom on to the title, I'm an introvert, and that's the only thing that defines you, then I think that can be constraining. One of the folks that was speaking in the preamble was saying that because of her professional role, she has to, in my terms, act out of character. She's introverted, but she has to act in an extroverted fashion for her professional roles. And one of the chapters of Susan Cain's book is precisely about this, chapter 9, and she talks about this strange Canadian professor at Harvard University who hid from his students but entertained them rapturously because he was a pseudo-extrovert. And that guy happened to be me.
Oh.
and I'm like many of your listeners. I'm what I call biogenically introverted. Part of my neurochemistry is such that I get over aroused with too much stimulation, and social stimulation is a good example of that which can be truly arousing. But and consequently, I need to retreat from too much stimulation in order to carry out my tasks or my projects effectively. And so we act out of character at times. So I'm a professor, and my chief core project in my life is to profess. And that means that we have to act in a somewhat extroverted way when we're lecturing or when we're on public radio. You don't want me to back off and say, I have nothing to say about that.
And you did a TED Talk.
Oh, yeah, I did. I'm trying now not to say anything so that you will see how hard it would be to be an introvert when you're playing into a social role and there are social expectations. Take a mom at a birthday party, and she's introverted. She acts as a pseudo-extrovert because she wants to put on an awesome birthday party for Emma. But at the end of it, she may be truly exhausted and want to retreat to the washroom and just quieten herself, whereas a true extrovert will have another party when the parents come to pick up the kids. And don't we need them all? Don't we need all these different kinds of people? And the other reason I think it's restricting to say, I'm an introvert, damn it, is that that's just one of five major dimensions of personality that we really need to take into account when we're understanding people. The other four are it spells out an acronym, OCEAN, so that openness to experience is one of them, conscientiousness is another, extroversion is the third, agreeableness is the A, and neuroticism is the N of OCEAN. And if you and each of these is independent of the other, meaning that you can be high on one or low, and high or low on each of the others. So the difference between an introvert who's disagreeable and neurotic is very different from an introvert who's agreeable and stable. And so simply to say that you're an introvert is cutting out all those other dimensions of personality, and I haven't even gotten into the subset of those characteristics that make us who we are.
We're talking with Brian Little right now. He's the author of Me, Myself, and Us, The Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. And he says it's a lot more complicated than just introvert and extrovert, and that by slapping ourselves with one of those labels, in particular this time introvert, we may be limiting ourselves and narrowing the scope of everything that we are. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Jennifer on the line with us in Fitchburg. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm actually finding it strangely liberating that I can now say I'm an introvert trapped in an extrovert's body. It's taken me 40 years to realize that that's the case. I have a very extroverted way of living. My careers are all very extroverted. People would think that I'm a lot more, whatever you want to define that as, extrovert. But I recently learned about the perspective that how you recharge has a lot to do with whether you are extroverted or introverted. I know one of your colleagues in the kind of preview mentioned that, too, that I definitely recharge with more solitude, even though I have a very outgoing sort of general lifestyle.
Interesting. What is your profession, Jennifer?
I teach math to middle schoolers, and I'm also a group fitness instructor, so those alone sort of pigeonhole me for people, but I really like my alone time, ironically.
Right. So you're out there. Jennifer, thanks so much for sharing that. And Brian, that is something that a way people define themselves. Do you think that's accurate? If you say I recharge by being alone, you're more introverted. If you recharge with people, then you're more of an extrovert.
Yeah, I think that is fair. I think the common element is that introverts need to recharge by reducing stimulation, and that can mean being alone or listening to soothing music or anything that is going to reduce the arousal level that you experience in the part of the brain we call the neocortex. For extroverts, recharging can be the exact opposite. They may find after, particularly if they have been acting as a pseudo-introvert because their job demands it, after work, they don't want just to be on their own. They want to get out and go crazy at a club or, depending upon where they are in the life cycle, and get stimulated. There's another aspect, though, of sort of cutting ourselves short and simply saying that we're an introvert, for example, instead of being open to the possibility that there were many different things during our daily lives. And that is some recent research by a fellow called John Zelensky, who's shown that when introverts and extroverts are asked to anticipate how they will feel at an upcoming social event, the introverts predictably say they won't enjoy it. However, if you actually observe them in those events, they enjoy it. And so what might happen is that introverts avoid situations that they would actually enjoy and benefit from, simply by regarding their settled views on what they're like as settled instead of negotiable and flexible.
Brian Little stays with us now. We're talking about being an introvert or an extrovert and how if we label ourselves with, for instance, the label introvert, we may be limiting ourselves too. Brian Little is the author of Me, Myself, and Us.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as an introvert or an extrovert? And either way, how important that is that to who you are? Is there a lot more to you than introvert or extrovert? Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? Do you, if you're an introvert, avoid that social occasion? Or if you go reluctantly, do you end up enjoying it anyhow? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our discussion now with Brian Little about why he says people who just consider themselves introverts are limiting themselves.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as an introvert or an extrovert? How does that affect you in your daily life? Is that the most important thing about you, or just one of a whole bunch of different things that you'd want people to know about you? How does being an introvert or an extrovert affect your life? How do you get along with the people on the opposite end of things? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll get to your calls in just a bit, but first let's hear more from one of our WPR staffers.
There's this popular quote that a lot of artists have been using. You hear it in movies, and it's the loudest one in the room is the weakest one in the room. And the more and more I kept coming across that quote, I'm like, well, I don't want to be perceived as weak. So I became more conscious of how soon I would speak, if I would be the first person to speak in the room, and how much I would speak.
So that's an interesting one. I mean, do you think, Brian, that there are prejudices against both introverts and extroverts, and we base our behavior a little bit on the ways that we think we might be perceived in that category?
Very much so. That was a really interesting observation that she made. And she's trying to modulate her behavior to live up to certain social expectations. I find that increasingly extroverts are becoming concerned that they are perceived as overly garrulous or coming on too strong, and they're attempting to modulate their behavior, just as more introverted people are trying to lean in more and be more socially engaged. And I think this captures more of what human personality is like than just the labeling of us as an introvert or an extrovert. We're constantly trying to negotiate our lives and craft our lives in ways that will sometimes embody one aspect of a trait dimension and sometimes another. And one other way in which I think it is limiting only to focus upon those traits is that I think a more central question is, what are the projects in your life that matter to you? And these personal projects, these core projects, are what drive our behavior. They may enjoin us to act out of character. Your most passionate project in your life is caring for your mom, because she's entered a stage of her life where she's beginning to experience some cognitive decline, and you're scared for her, and you're trying to get her into a facility, and there's intransigence and a buildup of resistance administratively, and so you, as a normally agreeable person, become strategically disagreeable for all of August. That, to me, is acting out of character. And it's to advance a core project of get my mom into a care facility that's right for her. And the same with extroversion and introversion. You can switch which end you experience or you enact to advance a core project. You may, however, risk burning out. And you can ameliorate that if you find what I call restorative niches, in which you can become your biogenic self after acting out of character. So, as a highly introverted person acting extrovertedly, you might find that you need to retreat into a restorative niche. Mine is a washroom with my feet up. Others may find that they're naturally disagreeable people, and they had to act agreeably, or a conscientious person has been asked to fake acting the opposite.
Let's get a couple of our callers in on this. A lot of people who are wanting to talk to you. This is Cynthia first in Strum. Cynthia, hi.
Hi.
What is your comment?
Well, I've always been introverted, and my whole life it's been wrong to be introverted. The social norm and acceptable was to be an extrovert, to want to go to parties and want to go to functions and want to be talkative and talk to people. So I've really enjoyed the last few years when it's become much more socially acceptable to say, hey, I'm an introvert. I'd rather stay home and watch a movie or stay home and read a book than go out and party with everybody. So to me, it's very freeing to be able to say, hey, no, I'm an introvert. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to do, and it's okay.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for that. And Cynthia's getting at what you were talking about earlier, Brian, that this is a liberating moment for a lot of introverts, because they do feel like it's okay to not engage as intensely with the world maybe as other people. But are you worried about someone like Cynthia, that she will take it too far and maybe not push herself to go to that party that you say she might enjoy if she goes?
I think it's something we need to be aware of. I think we have all assimilated the message that I think was really launched by Susan Cain's book. I think that point has been made, and it has formed what Susan Cain and others are calling a quiet revolution. And revolutions can play themselves out, but there may be some downside to taking it too far. And one of the downsides is, if you only think of yourself as an introvert, then your degrees of freedom, the amount of freedom you have to enact your life in a way that is meaningful and rich and so on, can be shortchanged.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Mary in Chicago. Mary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. I'm actually a clinical psychologist, and when I went back to graduate school in 2000, a couple of years in, we had to do the Myers-Briggs. And I came out all the way to the end of the E of extrovert. And so I call myself a capital E extrovert.
Ah, wow. And so have you experienced any sort of pushback, do you think, lately in the way extroverts are perceived, kind of like we were talking about, or do you fully embrace the extroverted part of you?
Oh, I fully embrace it. I can talk to anyone, anytime. I get along with most people. I've had some very good friends who are, some would say, introverted or shy. I'm comfortable in most situations. I'm quite outgoing in many areas. So I am fine with it. I laugh about being a capital E extrovert. We actually had to take it before we walked in the door the first day of the class. And the instructor said, gee, Mary, I've never seen anybody all the way to the end of a scale like this.
Wow, Mary is a capital E extrovert, and she's happy with it. Now let's take the flip side of this, Brian. Do you think that she could think about embracing maybe some of the positive qualities that might go around, that she might associate with introverts, the way that we're saying introverts could maybe embrace some of these other personality facets?
She sounds absolutely delightfully happy with her life, and I wouldn't want to step in and say, curtail yourself, woman, or bite your extroversion and hold your tongue. Of course not. Nor would I say that to an introvert who is happy and living a quiet, reflective, thoughtful life. What I do see, though, are particularly with my students, that they will sometimes, because they're not yet fully mature, they give themselves that identity that sticks with them for some time, and I think restricts the freedom they have to explore life, either by going out as an introvert into the crazy world that's out there, or for introverts, they may preclude themselves from turning inward and reflecting more about their life and having those quiet times that can be quite magical because they're so delightfully caught up in the buzz of social stimulation.
Well, Brian, it's been fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Brian Little, author of Me, Myself, and Us, A Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. He's a fellow of the Well-Being Institute and director of the Social Ecology Research Group in the Department of Psychology at Cambridge University. And you can find the link to his TED Talk on personality over on the Central Time Facebook page. He overcame his introversion to join us today, and we're glad that he did. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. In the wake of the Olympics, Latino USA takes a look at topics related to Brazilians and Brazilian Americans. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, a new report published by the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce shows that Wisconsin could have a shortage of nearly 4,000 doctors by the year 2035.
And according to that report, demand for doctors in the state could jump by 25% over the next two decades.
Joining us now to talk about the expected doctor shortage is George Quinn. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start. This is obviously a supply and demand issue. We'll get into some of the things that are being done about it, but I want to start on the demand side. Where do we see an increased demand for doctors in Wisconsin coming from?
Well, it comes from both the growth in overall population in Wisconsin, projected to increase by 12% over the next 20 years, but more importantly, by the increase of the over 65 population, which is expected to increase 69%. Folks that are 65 and over tend to place much more demand on health care, about 3.5 times as much as the overall average.
And this is a problem, I imagine, as the baby boomer population ages around the country. Wisconsin's probably not alone in this, but are we, as demographic trends go, a particularly aging state?
We are. We're probably in the upper half in that regard. And I think there are other states that would not necessarily be in the same situation 20 years from now. Florida is a good example of that. But in terms of the upper Midwest, Wisconsin's fairly typical.
And on the supply side, do we see not enough doctors being trained now to have them online and ready to rock in 20 years?
Yes, I think that's the multifactored problem there. Number one, while the over 65 population in Wisconsin is projected to increase by the amount we indicated, the working age population, the 18 to 64, is expected to decrease by 1%. So we have a very much of a mismatch here in terms of supply and demand. Secondly, we produce out of our medical schools and residency programs a number of physicians every year, but in no way at its current rate will keep up with what we need.
And of course, if the population as a whole aging, those doctors are part of that population. I imagine we're going to see a lot of those doctors aging, retiring out of the system and being just patients instead of being patients and doctors themselves.
That's true, although Wisconsin has a lower than average age in its physician workforce. So we do benefit from that. We're in one of the lower quartiles there in that regard.
So that's 20 years from now. Let's look at 2016 for a moment. How do we stack up now when it comes to the number of doctors out there versus the number of patients and hours they need to serve those patients?
Well, right now we're at a fairly good median point. There are anecdotal stories about shortages. The state of Wisconsin, however, does currently calculate an amount of shortages, but they tend to be isolated. In rural areas in particular, northern parts of the state, inner city parts of Milwaukee, for example.
Another wrinkle that's there in your report, we hear a lot of calls for better patient service by allowing doctors to spend more time with each patient that they meet. Obviously, if that's a goal of ours, that's going to put more stress on this doctor shortage in 20 years.
I think one of the strategies is likely to be more use of team-based care, where you, instead of having a physician meeting for the entire time of that visit, more other practitioners such as the physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, and so forth, so that we can better leverage physician resources.
We're talking to George Quinn. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce, looking at a projected shortfall of doctors in Wisconsin, especially in about 20 years. And George, I hit the word projected hard there. I know your organization and others are working on this now to try to make it so that we're not in that position. What kind of things are already happening in Wisconsin to try to deal with this projected shortfall?
Well, there are at least two positive developments in that regard. The first has to do with a relatively new state program, which provides grants to those organizations that wish to either start or expand graduate medical education. That's the period of training after graduation from medical school. And the reason that was taken as a strategy was that GME provides the best bang for the buck, if you will. Number one, there's a higher retention rate among GME graduates than from our own medical schools. About a third of graduates from our medical schools stay in practice in Wisconsin. About 50% from the graduate medical education program stay in practice, number one. So the retention issue is a very important one. Secondly, these programs can be started and implemented within, a three-year period at relatively low cost. So that's why we suggested that there be a grant program put into the state budget, and it's currently in the state budget. And that has some very positive results. 11 organizations have been granted money to either start or expand new GME programs. And up to this point, it will result in 73 new positions, every year 73 physicians being trained in these programs, graduating about 21 per year. So that's a positive development.
So you mentioned graduates of Wisconsin medical schools, only about a third of them end up staying in this state. Apart from this idea of graduate medical education, GME, that's what that stood for. What other ideas are there to try to keep more of those Wisconsin-trained doctors serving in Wisconsin?
Well, another very positive development was the Medical College of Wisconsin opening two new campuses, one in Green Bay and one in Wausau. The idea is from the kind of grow-your-own philosophy. The more likely that you are able to attract, let's say, college graduates into your medical school from that same state, the more likely you are to then have a higher retention rate. As a matter of fact, our statistics show that if you graduated from a medical school in Wisconsin and from a GME program in Wisconsin, there's a 70% retention rate. But that goes even further if that same student had graduated from a college or university in Wisconsin, that reaches 86%, pretty high rate. So that development has been very positive. Their first few classes that they have admitted have a very high percentage of students from Wisconsin, about 85 to 90%.
Do we have enough students, say, at the high school level in Wisconsin wanting to go into medicine? Or do we need to step up our efforts to recruit more high schoolers into medical school?
And it really needs to start right around that time, maybe even in middle school. And we have the Wisconsin AHEC program, the Area Health Education Councils, do a good job in that regard. But we need to step up that effort.
Are we at a place where we need incentives, apart from educating students here, incentives to stay and work in Wisconsin, maybe especially in areas where we're already seeing maybe problems recruiting general practitioners, specialists in rural or big city Wisconsin?
Well, I think that could come. I think right now our focus has been on making sure that we have enough graduate medical education slots, number one, and number two, that we're directing our attention towards Wisconsin-oriented folks, people who have some background in Wisconsin.
We sometimes hear about recruiting people from around the world to come to medical schools here and to practice medicine in the country. It sounds like that's not your starting point for meeting this gap.
That's not our priority at this point because we continue to fall back on our retention statistics and rely on those. And I think those have proven to be a very effective way to increase our workforce.
How about specializations? Do we expect to have a shortage in particular types of medicine?
Well, the areas that we've focused on are primary care, in other words, family medicine, for example, general surgery, those surgeons who do general type work, not the orthopedic surgeons and so forth, and psychiatry. Those are areas of particular need. Our grant program, the one that we were able to implement through the state budget, requires grantees to have to form or expand residency programs in those three specialties. They also need to have a fairly substantial component of the training take place in rural areas. So primary care, general surgery, psychiatry, and in rural areas. And that has proven to be very successful.
We're talking to George Quinn. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. He's joining us to talk about an expected doctor shortage coming up here in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you. Are you a doctor who's concerned about caring for patients in the event of a physician shortage? How do you think the state should reach out to prospective doctors? Or if you're a Wisconsin resident, what do you think about a potential pending doctor shortage? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your thoughts to talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about a potential shortage of doctors in Wisconsin in the next couple of decades, according to a new report published this week. And we want to hear from you. Are you a Wisconsin resident who's worried about a potential doctor shortage, or are you a physician who's facing this themselves? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if you're on the front lines of this, if you work in healthcare, in a hospital, or in medical education, we'd love to hear your perspective, too, at 800-642-1234. George Quinn is with us. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. That's the group that published this new study. George, before we go to our callers, talk about the worst case. We don't do enough to meet this. What does healthcare look like in Wisconsin in 20 years?
Well, I think we'd be facing, since we would have a gap, we would be facing issues relating to access and how will that population in the year 2035 gain access to providers that it needs? Those are unanswered questions at this point.
We'll bring on our callers now. Tom is with us in Waukegan, Iowa. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your expert talked about retention rates, but didn't talk about some of the reasons for the lower retention rates. And I'm wondering how welcome foreign, out-of-the-country trained medical staff really are here with the politics the way they are and my guess is that the retention rates there are not very high. I have some experience in seeing people leave. that Tom? I thought would stay.
Tom, thanks for the call. George, I don't know if your statistics go down this fine, but do we know whether foreign-born medical providers are staying here? Are we retaining them as well as anyone else?
No, I think we have the same experience as other states. Those retention rates tend to be lower, as you might imagine, folks. The farther away you are from your home state or homeland, for that matter, the more likely you are to not be retained.
Tom, thanks for that call. Go next to Rich on the line in Nina. Rich, hi.
Hello. I've got two kids that are about to go into college, and they're asking me, you know, what should we go for? And I'm like, with all the government regulations, you know, limiting, you know, what doctors can charge and all that, like, how can I recommend, you know, them going into the medical field?
Rich, thanks for that call. And we hear that sometimes, regulations, worry about malpractice, lawsuits, things like that. Are people steering clear, George, of becoming doctors?
Well, that has been cropping up more and more as a rationale for not entering the medical field. I think to a large extent, the reasons that folks enter the medical field is that they want to be caregivers. There are also those who seek, they're scientists and people who seek greater knowledge, and they tend to be those kinds of folks. So those who still want to provide care, who want to be caregivers, who want to help patients are the ones who tend to gravitate towards the medical field.
Rich, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to George Quinn. He's with the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce, looking at that organization's new report, looking at a potential shortage of doctors in Wisconsin in about 20 years. Still time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Are you in healthcare? Do you see this happening? Is this a slow-moving crisis? Do you train doctors? Are you in one of the medical schools here in the state? As a patient, do you worry about this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll take another caller. We've got Nick on the line in Madison. Nick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Nick?
So I'm actually a registered respiratory therapist. I have my bachelor's degree in respiratory science, and I have been closely watching the AARC website. For the creation of an APRT, which is an advanced practicing respiratory therapy position, which would put RTs on level with PAs and NPs, and it kind of in a way to help kind of get bridge the gap in the future shortcoming of physicians. I'm just kind of interested on what your guest has to say about something like that.
Nick, thanks for the call. So, George, something not more doctors, but maybe having certain kinds of specialists get more advanced training and licensing, presumably, is that potentially part of the solution?
I think it's both inevitable and necessary. We just will not be able to produce enough physicians to close the gap.
So what would we have to do to make something like that happen? Is that something the state would do to license? Is this a national medical issue? Who would have to take the lead on something like that?
Well, one of the issues has to do with licensure and broadening the current licensure capabilities of various practitioners. Secondly, in as much as there's a need to produce more physicians, there's also a need to graduate more nurses and nurse practitioners and other pharmacists who are also becoming part of a team-based care work group. And others, I think we need to be as flexible as we can, but at the same time, we need to understand that educational institutions, we need to admit more and graduate more of these other clinicians as well.
Thanks for the call, Nick. We'll go next to Marcy in West Allis. Marcy, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I was wondering if PAs are going to have to take on more of the responsibilities that doctors have, seeing as though we're going to have a shortage.
Marcy, thanks for the call. You'd mentioned physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners. Are we going to have to have more of them doing more of the work that currently goes to doctors?
I think that's going to be the case. The pattern of that, the model that's used in any particular organization will differ. Each health system will take on its own approach to this team-based care model, a different mix, if you will, of practitioners. So whether it's PA or it's an NP or even a pharmacist or other practitioners, that'll all be very unique to that particular health system.
Is this going to require a culture change that includes patients here? Because I imagine a lot of people come in and say, I want to talk to someone with MD after their name to talk about my problem.
I think that that's also something that's going to have to be accommodated, and it'll have to change. I know I'm aware of that kind of attitude towards various initials behind certain people's names.
Let's go to another caller. Thanks for that. We'll go next to Jill on the line in Wausau. Jill, hi.
Hi. I have a son who just graduated from medical school, and what they're being told at, there are more students in medical school than in the history of the United States, but there's a shortage of residencies that hospitals, because they're not receiving federal funding, oftentimes are cutting their residency programs or just making them in, like you say, into family medicine or surgery or psychiatry. And the other ones, he's in a residency right now, and when he accepted it, he wanted to go into dermatology. He's doing a transitional year, and that hospital has now dropped their dermatology residency.
Jill, thanks a lot for the call. So, George, a bottleneck not necessarily in the medical schools, but in the residency that you need. I don't fully understand how it works, but you need to do many specialties in medicine.
Well, again, residencies are the postgraduate training that's necessary, and various specialties require certain time frames for that. For example, family medicine requires 3 years, psychiatry 4 years, general surgery 5 years. One of the reasons, one of the impetuses behind our suggesting and implementing the state grant program was a recognition that these kinds of things are happening at the national level where we don't have as much control. In Wisconsin, we're able to control it a bit better by making these grants available, thereby providing incentives to health organizations, health systems to start and expand their own programs.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jill. So, George, this is a slow-moving crisis, which in a way is good news. It gives us more time to do things, and it takes time to train more doctors. Is it harder, though, because we're talking 20 years off, to create a sense of, I guess, urgency among people who would need to be on board to solve this?
Well, that is part of the problem. It's also, you know, you make a projection 20 years in the future that has many assumptions attached to it, but it's really necessary for us to do that. It takes about 15 to 20 years to train a physician. When you include the undergraduate, the medical school, and the postgraduate training and residency programs, it's anywhere between 15 and 20 years. So we need to look at these issues today if we want to make changes.
And do you see all the necessary parties at the table taking this seriously and starting to make these moves?
Well, there have been a lot of organizations that have stepped up to the plate, both in terms of the state government, as well as health systems, as well as the medical schools and the professions. So there's a general recognition of a need to deal with this problem, and a lot of folks have become engaged in it.
From the level of state government, briefly as we wrap up, if there's one thing that the legislature and the governor could work on that would help with this problem, what would it be?
Well, it would definitely keep in place our existing program and even expand it, because as we indicated in the report, the efforts taken thus far have been terrific, but they will not be enough. So we'll need to redouble that effort.
George, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to George Quinn to talk about a potential doctor shortage here in Wisconsin. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. His group released a report looking at this potential shortage we've been talking about and some ideas that can help address it. You can read that report, by the way, on our website, WPR.org. We've got a link to that also at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.